All good. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We are opening today's meeting of the Senate Healthcare and Human Services Committee, and we are going to open a public hearing on HCR 17. I'd ask Representative Boone to come up, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Deborah Boone, House District 32. And as you will see, HCR 17 is a resolution that declares a commitment of our Legislative Assembly to make lung cancer awareness a public health priority. And I know Dr. Steiner, Hayward, you probably can tell people more about this than I can, but I will attempt to do this. And I won't go through the entire resolution reading all the whereases, but when I was carrying this on the House floor, the stunning numbers that got me were an estimated 226,160 new cases of lung cancer were diagnosed in 2012. And of them, 2,920 were these new cases in Oregon alone. And of that total number, 160,340 died. And that's 28% of all cancer deaths. And only 15% of these cases are diagnosed in the early stages. So it's a particular challenge. And so being aware of this, all these numbers and this situation is tantamount to, the same things that we do in other parts of our lives, being aware of things and taking steps to do as much as we can for prevention and as much as we can to avoid this kind of cancer in our lifetime. And it's not always all from smoking. Many people contract this kind of cancer from other sources, and I know I had a couple of years ago, just about a little more than a month ago, a good friend and neighbor contracted lung cancer, and he was not a smoker. And it's a particularly hard thing to go through because when it's a close family member or a friend, because there's really nothing you can do. So anyway, I'm here to support this. You will hear from others on this resolution today, and I hope that you will. I just wanted to say too, it passed unanimously in the House side, so here we are in the Senate. I hope you can see fit to support it too. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions?
If you have questions, you have to ask the good doctor.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
I'm going to temporarily close the public hearing on HCR 17 to accommodate House members and open a public hearing on HCR 26. Representative Wisnow.
And Representative Boone.
You're a trooper this morning.
Okay.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. Thank you, and honorable committee members. For the record, I'm Gene Wisnett, House District 53, which is Senator Knope's Senate District. He works for me, and I work for him. So, as constituents, I'm proud to bring you House Joint Resolution 26. The resolution declares April as National Child Abuse Prevention Month. Committee members, I hate to bring this. It's terrible we have to have this resolution. However, more than 11,500 children were victims of abuse and neglect in Oregon during 2011. Greater than the number of children affected by cancer, juvenile diabetes, and autism combined. Children are most often abused, and this is sad too, most often abused or neglected by their parents, accounting for more than 80% of confirmed cases of abuse. Most of these children are younger than 6 years old. I could give you more statistics, but again, it's sad we have to do this. One of the ways we address the issue, of course, is parenting education. It's been proven as an answer to this challenge. And Oregonians have unique opportunities to support child abuse prevention services in all 36 counties by purchasing a Keep Kids Safe license plate, I hope I remember has, that Representative Boone and I passed last session, giving you the opportunity to support child abuse prevention efforts. You can participate in charitable checkoffs on your income tax, or you can volunteer to help in your local child abuse prevention programs. I hope the committee will pass this bill as soon as possible. Thank you. And my co-sponsor of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee, for the record, Deborah Boone, House District 32, and I'm here as the backup singer on this one, too. I have spent a lot of years working in child abuse prevention, having started in the treatment sector back when I was in college getting my degree in psychology. After a few months of working with kids who had experienced abuse and neglect, I decided I wanted to move into prevention and worked with our Governor McCall's sister, Jean Babson. She started the Oregon chapter of that National Committee for Prevention of Child Abuse. The numbers were much the same back then. I think the numbers were around 10 or 11,000. We still have that many cases of child abuse in Oregon. So I think rather than be negative about that, I'm going to be positive, because some of the things that have come out of our work are some of the things that Representative Wisnett just mentioned, plus a new thing, fairly new, and there are now 15 or 16 relief nurseries around the state, and they have a very, very good track record of treating and working with children, both in the prevention area and treatment area for child abuse and neglect. So This is a great resolution. We are in the midst of our Child Abuse Awareness and Prevention Month. You'll go down to the courthouse and see the, I think they're blue, ribbons on the tree, and the Pinwheel Farm out front. I spent 9 years on the Children's Trust Fund of Oregon. They do a lot of work, and they are the pass-through organization for these grants and that we see so many of in all areas, from business to government. And they also will be passing through money in the form from the license plate sales to child abuse prevention programs. Thank you.
Thank you. Just one clarification: relief nurseries work with the whole family, and not just the kids.
You are right. I stand corrected.
Yes, I have been an advocate of them for a long, long, long time, as you well know. Any questions of this panel?
Thank you. Have a good afternoon.
All right, thank you very much. You were the only one signed up, so we're just going to pass it.
That'll be great.
You're okay with that? Okay. I want to close the public hearing on HCR 26 and open a work session on HCR 26.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I recommend that HCR 26 be adopted and sent to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Steiner Hayward recommends HCR 26 be adopted and sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Call the roll.
Senator Steiner Hayward.
Aye.
Senator
Hill. Aye.
Senator Shield.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz.
Aye.
Chairman
Thompson. Excused. HCR 26 is passed. Senator Thompson, as one of the co-sponsors, will be the carrier of this bill. And I will close the work session on HCR 26. And I will reopen the public hearing on HCR 17. We will do this in two panels, I think. Barbara Ferguson and Lauren Sands. Because there's four people and four doesn't fit there, so we'll do it two and two. So. Welcome.
My name is Barb Ferguson. I'm from the Tigard area, Summerfield area of Tigard. I'm a surviving lung cancer patient going through treatment. I was diagnosed 2 years ago with stage 2B. I'm fortunate in that my cancer is slow growing, but it's also quite resistant to normal treatment, so it hasn't changed much in the last 2 years. Right now I'm in a clinical trial with OHSU, and I will have my first CT scan next month, so I don't know really how the trial is going. But I'm blessed to be very healthy and active. My lifestyle has not changed too much because of my disease. I've been able to continue to do what I normally do. So I'm very blessed in that way. So I'm here as a voice for lung cancer patients who are too ill to be able to advocate for the disease. I am in favor of this resolution. I don't think I said that in the beginning. There is a huge need for lung cancer awareness. I did not know many of the facts until I was diagnosed. Most people think that the only people that can get lung cancer are people who have smoked. I did smoke many, many years ago, quit a long time ago, over 30 years ago, but that's probably the cause of my disease. But we have found out that anyone who has lungs can get lung cancer. Two years ago when I was going through my treatment, I lost my hair, decided not to use a wig, and so I was walking around bald-headed, and people would come up to me and ask me if I was going through treatment. Usually they'd say, "And are you having treatment for breast cancer?" And I said, "No, lung cancer." And often they would say, "Oh, so you were a smoker." And it just really shocked me and made me sad that they thought I had done this to myself. And so people need to be aware of lung cancer, that it is the number one cancer killer, that anyone can get lung cancer. And we need to get rid of the stigma that only smoking can cause lung cancer. I'm also an advocate of early detection. If I had had a CT scan probably 3 or 4 years ago, this was before we knew that was how important that was, my disease probably wouldn't have developed to stage 2. If it had been found early, it would have been operable, and I would have had a far better prognosis than I have now, which is probably 3 to 5 years. I've lived 2. I'm doing well. Hopefully that will change. There's a lot of new medications that come out to help people with lung cancer. But people need to be more proactive with their doctors, those who are at risk, to ask their doctors about early CT scanning. I thank you for the opportunity to be here, and if you have any questions.
Please go ahead.
Hi, thank you very much. My name is Lauren Sant. I'm the executive director of the Caring Ambassadors Program. We're a nonprofit organization based in Oregon City, Oregon. Thank you, Senator Mona Sanderson, Vice Chair Senator Cruz, and panel for hearing a resolution today, having a public hearing. We are in support of HCR 17, making lung cancer a public health priority. Sadly, over 2,000 Oregonians will lose their lives to lung cancer every year. That's the case. 450 Americans die every day from lung cancer. And it's a lot of the stigma is the reason, because people aren't diagnosed early. They're afraid to ask. They're afraid to go to their doctors. They're afraid to get that early diagnosis. And sadly, only about 15% of cancers are actually found in that stage when they could be easily treated, and we can get that cure rate up to about 52%. So if we can get early diagnosis out there and early detection out there, we really can change the outcome of lung cancer for all Oregonians and for all Americans for that point. We have lots of statistics in my testimony. I'm not going to read them all to you, but just briefly, our organization was founded because of a lung cancer. A gentleman was told he had stage 4 lung cancer, told to go home and die. And his job was eliminated because he was dying, and nobody thought that they needed to tell him. And he survived. And so they asked him, "Well, what do you want to do?" And he said, "Well, I want to make people aware of lung cancer." And so he became an advocate and went out and really taught people about early detection and how to get into clinical trials and how it can save your life if you know where to get treatment and when to get treatment. So our organization wouldn't exist. The work that I've been doing for the last 15 years wouldn't have happened without this gentleman having that diagnosis and getting that message out there. And I know I appreciate his work and want to pass it on and make sure other people get diagnosed and that we catch people well before they are diagnosed with 3 to 5 years left of their life. And I'm just glad that doctors aren't God, and I'm hoping Barbara's got a lot longer than that. So thank you very much. And if you folks have any questions, I know we have some other lung cancer survivors here that would like to talk to you. So thank you.
Questions?
Thank you very much. Carrie Neeson and Jessica Steinberg.
You sure?
Sure.
Okay. My name is Jessica Steinberg. I'm from Cambie, Oregon. I sit before you today representing an emerging trend in lung cancer, diagnosis in non-smokers under the age of 45. If you have a set of lungs, you are at risk for lung cancer. As you've heard, lung cancer is the nation's leading cause of cancer deaths for both men and women. This year, lung cancer will claim more lives than breast, prostate, colon, liver, kidney, and melanoma cancers combined. It will kill more than 160,000 Americans this year. An estimated 60% of new lung cancer diagnoses will be in non-smokers like myself, and 15% of people who have never smoked. It is time for us to end the stigma associated with lung cancer and make sure that it is recognized as the public health priority that it is. It is baffling to me how often I am asked if I am a smoker when people learn of my diagnosis. I doubt anyone would ask a colon cancer patient if they always got enough fiber, or a breast cancer patient if they always did their self-exams. Yet somehow, lung cancer stigmatizes its victims. Lung cancer is therefore enshrouded in guilt, both for the victims and family members. The bottom line is no one deserves cancer, any cancer, regardless of personal behaviors or habits. All cancers are the direct result of three things: genetic, environment, and behavior. If someone is ill, don't they deserve all of our know-how, research, and talent to save them and allow them to live a productive life? Lung cancer patients seem to be the exception. When it comes to victims of this disease, society still plays the blame game. Lung cancer stands alone in that the prognosis for this disease in 2009 is the same as it was almost 40 years ago. I was 39 when I was diagnosed, quite by accident. I had no real symptoms, except I noticed in my marathon training I was having a great deal of trouble on the hills. Never did it cross my mind that I could have lung cancer. I thought I only needed to train harder. It was actually on this date, April 22nd, 2 years ago in 2011, that I was the victim of a serious assault. Ironically, it probably saved my life. I had a chest x-ray for broken ribs that detected a mass in my lungs. 1 week later, on April 29th, 2011, I was diagnosed with what was believed to be a stage 1 localized tumor. I had a major cardiothoracic surgery to remove a lung lobe, and during the surgery, it was discovered that the cancer was much more advanced than thought. Given my age and overall good health, and that I'm a single mother to two young boys, it was decided to initiate the strongest protocol possible. I had concurrent chemotherapy with chest radiation. I was incredibly sick and burned by the treatment. Unfortunately, the cancer only progressed and metastasized to my brain. I went through whole brain radiation, hence the hat, and tried another chemotherapy. I got worse, and the cancer spread to my bones. I refused to give up, determined to raise my boys to adulthood. It was at that point that it was discovered that I had a molecular biomarker of anaplastic lymphoma kinase, known as ALK. This change occurs in up to 5% of non-small cell lung cancers. In July 2012, a target therapy for the ALK mutation was approved by the FDA. I started it in December 2012, and at my scan a month ago, I learned the incredible news that no measurable cancer was detected. Stage 4 cancer is considered incurable, and the hard reality is even with medical miracles such as mine, the cancer often returns. It is my hope that by increasing recognition of the issue of lung cancer, we will also increase the survival rate. Despite the fact that lung cancer is the leading cause of cancer deaths in the United States, it remains the most underfunded and under-researched cancer. I hope that the passage of this bill is the beginning of bringing lung cancer into the spotlight. Right now, lung cancer is the forgotten cancer. Because of a 5-year survival rate of only 15%, there are few survivors to stand up and speak out in support of the disease. That's why it's so important for me to tell my story. I don't want anyone else to feel hopeless or feel as if they have no recourse because of no treatment options or a cure for this disease. Thank you for your time and attention in support of this incredibly important bill. I know my children thank you too.
Good afternoon, Chair Monis Anderson and committee members. That was amazing.
Thank you.
My name is Carrie Neeson, and I'm the Regional Director of Advocacy for the American Lung Association. And I think those that spoke before me told the story better than I ever could. I guess the one thing that I would like to add is lung cancer is the second most diagnosed cancer in our country. So there are a lot of folks that are hearing news like you and others have heard every day. And I also, when we talk about them out of research, I found an interesting chart today that shows the ratio of funding to cancer deaths in our nation. And I think it really illustrates how underfunded lung cancer research is. For breast cancer, for every breast cancer death, our nation spends about $22,000 per death. On lung cancer, it's less than $1,500. So we have a real disparity. I believe it is the forgotten cancer, and we really appreciate your support of this resolution to bring more awareness and hopefully more research dollars to lung cancer.
Thank you so much for coming to testify, both of you. But the personal stories have such a strong impact on us, and that just makes it us all the more aware that we need to do more. Senator Steiner Hayward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is more of a comment than a question, mm-hmm. because I think it's really important to point out, I'm a family physician. I'm a member of the Knight Cancer Institute, OHSU. I do a program, run a program on breast cancer early detection. And what I would say is that you are not alone. We are seeing more and more young women being diagnosed with breast cancer, and we are seeing more and more people develop cancers at earlier ages that used to be cancers of old age. We need to be doing a lot of work at the root causes. We're fortunate that we have great researchers in this state and nationwide doing important things. It's kind of timely that this is OHSU mm-hmm. Day at the Capitol, since Dr. Drucker, who directs the Knight Cancer Institute, developed one of the first targeted therapies for a specific mutation of the kind that you're now benefiting from, thank goodness. I want to thank you for taking the time to bring your, I'm very pleased you brought your boys. It's very important for them to see that everybody can make a difference and that your voice can be heard mm-hmm. and make a difference. But I do think it's important for everyone to understand you are not alone. We are seeing this more and more, and we have to understand more about the complex causes of cancer, especially in younger people. So thank you very, very much.
Yes, Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In my district, where radon is especially high, the links between lung cancer and radon are just starting to now come to the surface and only beginning to be addressed. So hopefully this bill will help shine some light on that, too.
I hope so, too. Thank you.
Any other comments? Discussion. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I would like to close the public hearing on HCR 17 and open a work session on HCR 17.
Madam Chair, I move HCR 17 with a do adopt motion and that it be referred to the Senate floor with a do pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves HCR 17 be adopted with a do-pass recommendation to the floor. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Steiner Hayward?
Aye.
Senator Knopf?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chair Monticelli?
Aye. Motion carries. And Senator Steiner Hayward, would you carry this bill?
Thank you. I'd be honored to, Madam Chair.
And I will close the work session on HCR 17. And
Before you do that, do you want to vote on this one?
Oh, yes.
Okay. So, Madam Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of allowing Senator Mona Sanderson to vote on HCR 26.
Senator Cruz moves that the rules be suspended so that the chair could vote on HCR 26. Any opposition to that? I vote aye.
All right. I knew you'd
want to
do that.
We'll let it slide.
We'll let it slide this time.
All right. I didn't have to open anything. Okay, I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 2081.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2081 modifies exemptions to the prohibition against the practice of psychology or representation of a psychologist without a license, limits a graduate student exemption to students seeking academic credit as part of an organized and supervised training program. No fiscal or revenue impact on the bill, Madam Chair. And the House floor vote was 58 ayes, one excused, and one excused for legislative business.
All right. Is it Shane Hayden?
Good afternoon, Senator Moynihan Sanderson and panel members. My name is Dr. Shane Hayden, and I am the chair of the Oregon Board of Psychologist Examiners. As was pointed out, this is a concept to narrow the current limitation that allows graduate students that are unlicensed and unsupervised to practice psychology. How that has existed in our current rules is an absolute mystery to most of us and was probably not tested until a recent case arose. The solution to this is, again, as mentioned, that we will restrict the practice of graduate students to only those situations in which for which they receive academic training as part of their continuing education program and that is under the supervision of a qualified licensed psychologist.
Pretty straightforward. So a person cannot supervise if they are in a graduate student, according to the language, and or a person pursuing certification, licensure, or graduate degree. So they would be exempted.
Correct.
Any other questions?
As an aside, Senator Moynihan Sanderson, an unrelated, I too am a survivor and totally support the concept of the previous legislation.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. All right. Seeing no discussion, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 2081A and open a work session on House Bill 2081A.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2081A to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2081A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator
Hibbert? Aye.
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chair Monson?
Aye. Motion carries, and I will carry the bill, and I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2081A and open a public hearing on House Bill 2082.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2082 comes to the committee at the request of the State Board of Licensed Social Workers. It modifies definitions relating to social work, modifies the composition of the board, and has an emergency clause. This has no revenue impact, minimal fiscal impact. This had 56, the House floor vote was 56 aye, 1 no, and 3 excused.
Good afternoon, Chair Moynihan Sanderson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Martin Pitioni. I'm the Interim Executive Director for the Board of Licensed Social Workers, and to my left is Kathy Outland, board member, who will hopefully briefly present House Bill 2082 today. I do have pretty extensive written materials on the background of this bill, and I leave it to the pleasure of the chair whether you would like me to go through them. I can also instead do a high-level summary for you and instead open up for questions. While you think about that question, what I'd simply like to say up front as an introductory statement is that what's really happening here today is a journey that began in this committee under the leadership of the of former Senator Bill Morissette 4 years ago, January 28th, 2009 to be exact, where basically this committee asked this board, in response to a bill we brought forth in 2009, Senate Bill 177 in its original form, to do more. In that session, basically, the board brought an agency bill that simply added two non-clinical license types to the license lineup for the board, and we were told very clearly that this was not going to be sufficient and that we needed to do more because everybody knew that the elephant in the room was our inability to regulate at least the clinical side of social work on a mandatory basis. And this started, quite frankly, a long journey that ended with passage of a much improved bill in 2009 that included those protections, including mandatory a practice act for clinical social work, mandating licensure for clinical social work with some very, very hard-fought and hard-sought exemptions limited exemptions, and added the new license types that we had asked for, and provided for very exciting title protections for the term social worker, now requiring that you have to be both degreed and licensed by the board. This bill before you today is a successor bill to Senate Bill 177 that's easiest and best thought of as essentially filling in some of the small undone pieces we weren't able to get to in the 2009 session. One of the ways that you can see the progress here is that this hearing room is not full. I assure you it was full in 2009. We've done a lot of work with our stakeholders on this bill, and both in 2009 and since on implementation, keeping the peace, making sure our stakeholders were happy, which is why you have a harmonious and hopefully short hearing today. So, Madam Chair, I can go through this pretty briefly if you'd like me to, but that's kind of the very broad picture of why we're here with you today. So basically, this is what I just talked about, is that in 09, we started this journey out with Senate Bill 177. There was a significant public protection issue, and it was, quite frankly, a source of significant embarrassment to us that even when it came to revoked licensees of the Social Work Board, we had no authority to stop conduct that was harming the public. In essence, if a clinical social worker lost his or her license for sexual misconduct with a client, the only consequence was that they had to basically stop using the title while they continued to sleep with their client. And it was not a very good scenario for us, and that kind of led to that request to do more that I referred to a few minutes ago by then Senator Morissette. What's happening now is, and the context for this bill, is that we have a mandatory practice act in 675.523. It does mean that you have to have one of the clinical license types, which is either a certification as a CSWA, that's a clinical social work associate. That's basically, you can think of this as our training program, where you are under supervision. It's not independent practice, and you have to stay under supervision by a licensed clinical social worker while you're in training toward full independent licensure as a licensed clinical social worker. So you either have to have that certification or the full independent license as a licensed clinical social worker in order to engage in the practice of clinical social work. There is a pretty narrow set of exemptions to that piece, but we are not, and I'm going to say that probably one or two times loud and clear, nothing in this bill changes what we did in 2009 around arguing over who's exempt or not, or changing the language of the exemptions, because that's part of what we're doing to basically keep the peace today, and also to make sure that there is no significant fiscal impact. We have now two voluntary options for those that are not practicing clinical social work. So we have now at the bachelor's level what is called the Registered Baccalaureate Social Worker, or RBSW certification. And we have at the master's level the licensed master social worker, LMSW license. They do not, neither one of those allow clinical practice, but they are ways for folks to come on a voluntary basis to get licensed. Now, I want to just say for the record that we have had very significant growth since the passage of 177 at this board. About 21% in the previous biennium, and about 18% additional growth in the current biennium. Why? Including in those voluntary license types, part of the incentive is driven, quite frankly, by the title protection and by pride. People want to be able to call themselves a social worker, and the only way they can do that now is, even on the non-clinical side, is if they come in and get licensed. It was one of the drivers toward, for that growth. Now, what we didn't do in 2009 and what is being done by this bill is that we were not able to get consensus in 2009 on how to approach the issue of definitions for especially the non-clinical practice types. And bluntly put, I'll just put this on the record, the reason for that was very simple. There were those that feared that if we were going to write in a definition, that it would automatically result in the board trying to mandate it. This bill does not do that. In fact, I worked very hard with legislative counsel, and I want to kind of put on the record a big thank you to Mark Meyer in the legislative counsel's office on the exact language of this bill, and it's not a coincidence that ORS 675-523, which is the practice act that really has the big trigger for us, is not modified by this bill. That allowed us to keep the commitment to our stakeholders that we would not open up the practice act, we would not open up the issue of the exemptions, and it provides us with some protection that it wasn't going to happen as part of this legislative process either. So bottom line is that this bill really is not a changing of the framework of what we did in 2009. It's more of a filling in the blanks by, one, adding definitions we currently don't have. And trust me, it's a significantly awkward position to issue licenses on a non-clinical side without having a clearly defined scope of practice for those licenses. So we are adding those in as part of this bill. So that's one part, critical part here. And we are replacing the clinical definition in the same process by essentially using a framework that comes out of work done nationally, and board member Kathy Outland can speak about that in more detail, that and draws on that work, which is what we originally proposed in 2009, and bring that into our regulatory framework. So bottom line is, we're removing the clinical practice definition as it is now, effective January 1, 2015, under this bill, and replace it with an integrated set of definitions that come out of that work done nationally through the Association of Social Work Boards over many, many years, that basically says, here are, you know, model practice definitions for those three layers integrated, and that's where that language comes from. It is not Oregon specific. It is basically work done nationally in the social work profession that you see reflected in this bill. The other piece that's, that this bill does is that it also addresses one small governance issue for this board, which has the support of the governor's office, which basically says that one of the four, this is a seven-member board operation. Of those seven members, four have to be, under current statute, licensed clinical social workers, so at the highest level of the level of licensure, and the other three are under statute public members. What this bill does, it says, without expanding the size of the board, so no fiscal impact because of that, that the governor's office has permission to take one of the four existing professional member positions and have the option of basically appointing anyone into that slot at any level of licensure. So non-clinical, clinical, master's level, bachelor level, any one of the four license options that we offer, LCSW, CSWA, RBSW, LMSW, are eligible to be represented in that slot. And that's kind of a governance issue, a small tweak, because we did feel awkward as we were growing over time that we now have close to 1,000 licensees out of a total 5,000 licensee board now that basically had no shot at having any representation on the board. And this bill basically opens the door without creating a fiscal impact on that front. Bottom line is, we are not changing the, you know, the big piece that all the negotiations happened over in 2009, which is 675-523 ORS. Mm-hmm. No changes to the mandatory practice, no changes to the exemptions. We are updating the clinical definition for licensed clinical social workers. There is no significant impact on the on the CSWAs, and the only change for them is that they are eligible for board representation. The key really here is that on the non-clinical side, the licensed master social workers and the registered baccalaureate social workers, they gain a scope of practice and are able to be considered for service on the board. So those are really the key impacts of what you have before you today. And other than that, I think you possibly have folks signed up to briefly talk about their support, but the social work stakeholders, particularly associations, are supportive of this bill. We know of no organized opposition to this bill.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Good afternoon, Chair Moniz, Anderson, and Vice Chair Cruz, and to the rest of the members of this wonderful committee. My name is Kathy Outland. I'm a licensed clinical social worker, and I'm a newly appointed board member here, and I live here in Salem. I have, however, served on the board in the past and have been part of this process, actually, since we began this, actually much sooner than 2009, but probably back in the year 2000, we've been talking about public protection and the ability to have social workers be held accountable for, unfortunately, grievances that happen to consumers, and that really is our primary focus. The Association of Social Work Boards is really an association of all of the states and all of the provinces, minus California, although they have joined back. So we can actually say all of our states, plus all of the provinces of Canada. And the Practice Act and is one where we're getting the definition, the broad definition for clinical social work, which has been updated through many, many years of study and dialogue through the professional organizations of National Association of Social Work Boards, as well as all of the regulators who are social work regulators in the states and provinces. So what we have here are definitions that have been devised and crafted to really meet the current definition of what social work is at the various levels. And one of the things that happened here in Oregon that's very exciting but also challenging is that we never had bachelor's of social work programs up until the 2000s. And so now we have, you know, schools of social work that are producing bachelor's of social work students that are graduating with bachelor's, and that means that they are going to be able to have their master's in 1 year instead of a two-year master's program, post-BS program. So it's a very exciting time, but also in terms of regulation and in terms of public protection, a very important thing that we have good definitions for scope of practice and that we have the ability to promote that and also be available to attend to the complaints that we may get in the future, because we have so many more social workers in the state that are providing services, and we want to ensure public safety.
Thank you. Comments?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Hopefully we won't have more and more of them going out of business as reimbursements continue to get squeezed.
Thank you for noticing that, Senator Shield.
All right, we have one more to testify, Caleb Hayes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, you will.
Yes.
Welcome.
Good afternoon. My name is Caleb Hayes. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon chapter of the National Association of Social Workers, also known as the NASW. The NASW Oregon chapter has 1,800 members, and our mission is to promote, develop, and protect the practice of social work and social workers. I'm here today to put on the record our support of HB 2082. This is a straightforward change, cleaning up language and statute. The NASW's executive committee voted unanimously to support HB 2082, and we urge you to do the same.
Great. Comments? All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Would like to close the public hearing on House Bill 2082 and open a work session on House Bill 2082.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2082 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2082 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? The clerk will call the roll.
Senator Hewitt?
Aye.
Senator Knopf?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries, and Senator Shields will carry the bill. And I will close the work session on Senate Bill 2082 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2094A. Sandy.
2094A comes to us from the House Health Care Committee with a pretty close, with a 59-aye, one excuse vote. It aligns state law with federal law regarding the state health officer seeking information on medical facility exposure to infectious diseases. There's no revenue impact and the minimal fiscal impact on the bill, Madam Chair.
All right. Dr. Cohn.
Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Dr. Mel Cohn. I'm the director of the Public Health Division at the Oregon Health Authority and the state public health officer. And I'm here today to testify on House Bill 2094A. This is a bill that we have called our technical fix bill. There were some initial problems with the first round of the bill, and we introduced amendments when this was before the House committee. And there are a number of things that this bill does. I think they are fairly straightforward. The first is to address a federal requirement that was imposed on the person in my position in 2009. There's a requirement that I identify a designated officer of each employer of emergency response employees. So this is not something that's taken care of through or OSHA, and our role is simply to identify who these designated officers are. The emergency responders are already required to have these officers, so there is no new burden that's put on them. They simply have to let us know who the designated person is. The second thing that happens in Section 2 in this bill is to delete some outdated references. For example, there's a reference to duties imposed under ORS Chapter 690 that the health authority is supposed to do. Well, the health licensing agency currently does those. So this simply changes that to clean that up. Similarly, the State Health Commission, we're required to have books, papers, documents, and property that have belonged to the commission. We're supposed to have been transferred to us many, many years ago. So again, this is deleted from the statutes. The next issue is about healthcare acquired infections. This simply makes the responsibility for carrying out this program more general for the health authority, rather than currently it's at the Office of Oregon Health Policy and Research. And so this changes that to make it the health authority. And in fact, the Public Health Division is doing a lot of that work currently. So this cleans that up as well. And then finally, in Sections 3, 4, and 5, there's some changes in the definition in home health and in-home care. None of these are really terribly substantive. They came out of requests from our community partners, but I don't believe that there's anything terribly controversial about them. So, for example, changing a reference to within an hour's drive to within 60 miles, that kind of thing. So with that, I will stop. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Madam Chair, I'm just disappointed that I had a bunch of questions, but they're more for Katie King, and since she's back there.
Well, you're the only one to testify. There seems to be no other discussion. So I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2094A and open a work session on House Bill 2094A.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2094A to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2094A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
clerk will call the roll.
Senator Sandra
Hubert? Aye.
Senator
Snow? Aye.
Senator Shields?
Excused.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries, and ordinarily I like to carry the public health bills, but I'm going to let Senator Cruz carry this one. With that, I will close the work session on House Bill 2094A and open a public hearing on House Bill 2329.
Madam Chair, House Bill 2329 comes to us from the House floor with 56 ayes, 4 excused. It designates November of each year as Chronic Obstructive Pulmonary Disease, otherwise known as COPD, Awareness Month. This declares an emergency is in effect on passage. There's no fiscal or revenue impact on the bill, Madam Chair.
All right. Carrie Neeson and Cynthia Gage. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon again, Madam Chair and committee members. Again, my name is Carrie Neeson, and I serve as the Regional Director of Advocacy for the American Lung Association of the Mountain Pacific. And we really appreciate you hearing this bill today. It's an opportunity for us to bring awareness to Oregonians and other stakeholders about a critical disease that is the third leading cause of death in our country. Most of us take between 21,000 and 22,000 breaths every day. And for us, it's easy. We don't think about it. We breathe in and out, and it just happens very automatically. For those people with COPD, simply breathing in and out can be very, very difficult. Our lungs are kind of like an inverted tree, and at the very end of the tree are sacs called alveoli. And that's where gases are exchanged. That's where our body takes in good oxygen-rich air, and we breathe out the poisonous air that our body uses. For us, for people who breathe easily, it happens automatically. For people with COPD, the directions of both of these exchanges are very, very difficult. Most of us have experienced a cold or had allergies, and we have those days when we can barely breathe because we're so congested. We can breathe 1 minute, and the next minute we're all stuffed up. The membranes in our nose swell, it's hard to breathe, we're coughing all the time, we're producing a lot of mucus, our sleep is disrupted, and we're just really miserable. This is the same process, it's a similar process that's happening in the lungs of people with COPD each and every day. It's like a moth has eaten away at the supportive tissue that supports the lungs. And people with COPD can never fully exhale. So if a person just keeps breathing in, and you keep breathing in, and you keep breathing in, and you never are able to exhale, it kind of gives you a feeling for what people with COPD are like each and every breath. It's the mission of the Lung Association to save lives by improving lung health and preventing lung disease. And we're very passionate and very invested in improving the quality of life for the 175,000 Oregonians with lung disease. So we thank you for your consideration of this important legislation.
Thank you.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for your time. I am smoking.
State your name for the record first.
Huh?
State your name for the record.
Cynthia Gage. Smoking, nicotine addiction, like 90% of COPD sufferers, is the source of my disease. I smoked for 46 years, trying to stop quite a few times, but mostly giving up because it is so addictive. Insidiously, COPD started creeping into my life. Shortness of breath caused me to adjust my life, and yet I kept on going. After a few years, gradually life had changed entirely because of COPD. I no longer owned a home because of COPD. I no longer had a job. I had no income. My health was poor, and all because of COPD. Now, 10 years later, daily living requires moving slowly to get medications of inhalers, nebulizers, pills each morning and several times throughout the day to allow for breathing. Even bathing and getting dressed are exhausting and require my sitting down a few times. Carrying a bag or a purse, et cetera, running errands are very tiring. It is a continued psychological and physical battle to force myself past the shortness of breath and fear of not being able to breathe. Not being able to breathe is like drowning, gasping for air, trying not to panic and not being able to breathe. It is terrifying. To come to Salem today, I needed to go through the wall of fear and panic. I asked to be driven in case I became too tired or had a breathing emergency. I needed to know how long it would be down here so I'd know how much extra oxygen to bring. I'd have to bring a simple trip becomes a journey, and I will rest most of tomorrow because today's traveling and breathing and walking will have tired me so much. Oxygen is considered a medication and is only one of many that I need to take for COPD. The cost of copays runs me $150 to $200 per month, an amount that has required me to have additional SS Social Security help called Extra Help to cover the costs of medications. I get assistance from Oregon Trail Card for food. I get help with my phone, my heat, my property, my tax. COPD has become an expensive way of life and takes from the public service as well, and certainly shortens my life. COPD is a hard way to live and is not for sissies. I am only one person. There are many. I would see COPD a month being able to bring awareness to people who suffer from it and don't recognize they're suffering from it, for the medical community to bring it into a higher awareness level. Of course, there's always thought of funds going into that too. But it's people, there's a shame of it by the people who have it. They don't like to admit it. They often don't wear oxygen or use the medication because of the stigma. That was an aside, but I just, this is my case, and it's not unusual, but there are others. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, and thank you for making the effort to come down to testify, because that really does mean a lot to the committee. For us to hear, I mean, it makes it so much more, makes
real.
You so much more aware of seeing someone who is suffering from COPD. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Senator Steiner Hayward.
Thank you. I lost my aunt 10 days ago from COPD.
I'm so sorry.
I lost my father almost 7 years ago from COPD. I lost my father-in-law 11 years ago from COPD. This is a critically important issue. The Senate, this committee passed through my bill to ban smoking in cars when children are present to try to reduce their exposure, to reduce children's nicotine dependence, which they get from secondhand smoke. I know how hard it was for you to come down today. I'm a physician, and I'm the relative of three people who struggled with this disease. So thank you very, very much. Thank you for your advocacy. Thank you for your bravery. And thank you for telling your story. And we will do everything we can to make sure that fewer and fewer people have to tell the same story over time.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Seeing no other comments or discussion, I would like to close the public hearing on House Bill 2329 and open a work session on House Bill 2329.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2329 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2329 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator
Sandgren?
Aye.
Senator Snow?
Aye.
Senator
Shields? Excused.
Senator
Cruz? Aye.
Aye. Motion carries, and Senator Steiner here would like to carry this bill, and I will close the work session on House Bill 2329, and nothing else on the agenda?
No, Madam Chair.
Then we are adjourned.